everybody. This is Chris. Welcome to the Sausage of Science. Eric will be along in just a second. I believe he is pulling the king cake out of his teeth. I'm sorry. He's pulling the baby out of his teeth after finishing off the king cake. Oh my God. That was a terrible joke. I was just trying to make it because we are speaking today with Dr. Leslie Gregorica, who is bioarchaeologist and professor of anthropology in the Department of Sociology, Anthropology, and Social Work at the University of South Alabama. University of South Alabama is in Mobile, Alabama, and Mobile, Alabama is the home or where Mardi Gras started. So as you'll hear in this interview, Dr. Gregorica has an abiding interest in Mardi Gras as a resident there. But more about her background. She's also the director for the U.S. Forensic Science Program. She received her BA from Notre Dame and her MA and PhD from Ohio State. And in her training, she learned how to use biogeochemical techniques to examine changing patterns of human mobility, mortuary practices, paleo diet, and social complexity. And the region of interest or her region of expertise is the Near East, Arabia, and beyond. Her primary research program is in investigating prehistoric mortuary remains across the United Arab Emirates and Oman, and looking to evaluate shifting mortuary traditions of that area. She also recently wrapped up an NSF REU site called Bioarchaeology of Bronze Age Social Systems. And she's done some work in Poland, working on the Drosko Cemetery and its well-known deviant burials, which I will just leave hanging there to entice you so you will listen. So without further ado, after that mumbled introduction, welcome, Dr. Leslie Gregorica.
Hey, Chris.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm excellent. Good, good. Well, welcome to the show. Sorry about last week. I had I had a dishwasher go south on me. I was on spring break. No, I'm on spring break this week, but everybody else's spring break in this damn state was last week. Nothing against the state of Alabama, right?
It would be nice to have some consistency.
Mm-hmm. Here's my co-host right now.
He's okay.
Just made it in. What's up, Eric?
Hi, team. Sorry, this is one of those meetings all day back to back to back.
You're 100% okay. I'm just going to jump right into it. We always start off each episode the same way. The show is called The Sausage of Science. We want to know what goes into the science. And we always start off with you guys, the scientists. So tell us about you, where you're from, what got you interested in anthropology, your route, and how you ended up being blessed along with me to be living in Alabama and teaching our fine residents.
I was born and raised in a small town in Michigan, and I know people can't see this, but it's true. We do use our hands to show where we are from. And I think I was just that sort of stereotypical kid who was interested in things like mummies from ancient Egypt and dinosaurs and bones. Actually, in my very pink bedroom when I was a kid, I had this dresser that was covered in, do you remember those wooden kits where you could put the dinosaur skeletons together? I don't even know if those still exist. And I remember just loving that kind of skeletal puzzle. And I even remember that around second or third grade, we had this speech writing contest about what we wanted to be when we grew up. And I spoke about wanting to be an archaeologist. Although, unfortunately, I did not win that contest. I got second place to a girl who wanted to be a marine biologist. So, you know, I'm still trying to get over that loss. But
the other most common childhood dream that almost exactly. Nobody ultimately, I think my sister was a marine biologist and actually made it to undergrad and then went, so.
Exactly.
Well, here's the real question, Leslie. Do you know if that other girl in that class became a marine biologist?
I have no idea. I lost track of her, so I would be very curious to know.
So, but just a side question then, did you subscribe to Dig magazine and submit drawings and stuff? This may be a little, because you're this is something my kids did, so I don't even know if it was around then, but just curious, because that was something I had my kids doing to see if they would like developed along those lines?
I'm not sure it was around either. I did not subscribe to that. We had Highlights magazine, and so that was always enjoyable. But Dig magazine, I'm not sure. But yeah, they have all these great resources for kids now. Even the National Geographic, the small little booklets are fantastic. And I know my niece and nephews really love looking through those. I guess, you know, unlike a lot of kids who eventually grow out of wanting to be these things, I never really did. And kept up with that interest and declared my anthropology major on my second day of college and just never really looked back. I ended up doing my undergraduate work at the University of Notre Dame, and my experiences there were really pivotal in what would ultimately determine my career path. In particular, there was a National Science Foundation program there called an REU, and that stands for Research Experiences for Undergraduates. And we were essentially taught how to conduct research and how to put a project together. And my project happened to be on isotopes and what the chemistry of bones can tell us about what people ate in the past. And in that REU program, I learned a ton about bone biochemistry and how to analyze these kinds of samples. And after that, I went to Ohio State, got my master's degree and PhD there, and I continued to work with isotopes, and I still do to this day. After graduating, I applied for just about every academic job out there, as I think most of us do at that stage. And I ended up needing to choose between an anatomy position and a job in bioarchaeology. And I chose the bioarchaeology position at the University of South Alabama. That was 12 years ago now, and I'm still here and enjoying life on the Gulf Coast.
Do you remember how many applications you sent out? I think I sent out 54.
Oh, I don't remember. It was quite a few, including for some jobs that I was clearly not.
Yes, same. Like yeah. Really, really, like maybe one word was in my dissertation related to the job. But yeah,
exactly. But I want to say there were only something like 7 bioarchaeology jobs that year. It was so small. And people now are doing research on that kind of topic, on the availability of these positions and sort of the overproduction of PhDs, which I think is really interesting.
That's funny. Now I feel like reviewer requests are like that, where like if you have one word cited in an article about a completely different topic, they'll be like, hey, you're an expert on that thing that you mentioned once in a discussion. Would you like to review this article on it? And I'm like, this is incredibly inappropriate. I am not qualified to respond to this.
That is so true.
So you study strontium isotopes from skeletal tissues to investigate human mobility. Mm-hmm. How does this tell you about where people are moving and migrating? And is this like going to work in the next village over and coming back, or movement on a larger time scale?
Yeah, it's kind of wild to think about the fact that these chemical signatures in our skeleton can actually act as these sort of geographic tracers for where we've lived and how we move around. So isotopes are just these different kinds of atoms that make up our environment, and these are going to be incorporated into our teeth and bones as we eat and drink. And with strontium in particular, these are coming mainly from bedrock. And because of this different combination of rock types that make up different kinds of bedrock, it's going to be unique to a given area. And so what we find is that these different regions have these distinctive isotopic signatures, particularly for strontium. And these isotopes eventually, they sort of pass through these soils and water into the plants and animals that we eat as humans. From a chemical perspective, strontium is really similar to calcium. And we obviously know that calcium makes up a pretty significant chunk of our bones, right? These strontium isotopes actually become trapped in our skeletal tissues. And so we can sample teeth or bone from someone's skeleton to see whether their isotope ratios are similar to the isotopes available in the place where they're buried. If they are similar, that person probably grew up there. But if that person's isotopes are different from those in that burial environment, they probably grew up somewhere else, and that somewhere else is going to be geologically different. What I think is really neat about all of this is that different parts of your skeleton form at different times. So, for example, your first molar is going to form earlier than your second molar, and that enamel from your teeth, it only forms during childhood. So we can actually sample multiple teeth from a single individual to see how they were moving around. And the trick to all of this is the fact that in order for us to detect that kind of mobility, we do need to have different kinds of bedrock between the places where people are moving. And so if people are moving between areas with similar geologies, we really aren't going to be able to detect that, unfortunately.
It sounds like you probably have an expertise in this methodology and work with a lot of different collections. Am I making a correct assumption there?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me a little bit about then how your work. How do you get involved in a project? Is it a question you have and you find a collection, or is there a collection or an excavation? How do you become involved in a project?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, I think. So my primary area of focus is the Middle East, and most recently I've worked in the Sultanate of Oman and in the United Arab Emirates. And so in those places we have these really large communal commingled tombs that date to thousands of years ago. And we have these questions sort of about how they're interacting with local communities, how they're interacting more interregionally. And isotopes like this can help us to answer questions about those sorts of interactions. You know, are people moving with traded goods, or, you know, do we have something else going on where maybe we have these sort of local way stations where traded goods are being moved so that people aren't actually moving these long distances? And we also want to know, are non-local individuals from other places like neighbors in Mesopotamia or the Indus Valley, are they moving into these local regions in southeastern Arabia? And how do those interactions with non-locals tell us about the social structure of people living in the Bronze Age, of these smaller local communities?
So I'm wondering, does your work speak at all about the complexity of these societies that are previously considered to be secondary?
I would like to think it does. I mentioned the work that I do primarily in the UAE, and so I can talk about that a little bit more specifically and how it applies to that question. And I think that a lot of people who work in that region of the Gulf, where you have these big urban centers like Mesopotamia, like the Indus Valley, they think about southeastern Arabia as sort of this backwater or this periphery that, you know, was contributing to trade, but really didn't play that much of a role. It's just sort of this marginalized place. But instead, what I am finding when I look in these communal Arabian tombs is that we have non-local individuals being interred in those tombs, and they're being commingled right alongside with those local individuals instead of being buried in individual graves, which is what we see in places like Mesopotamia. It's what we see in places like the Indus Valley. And this is really striking to me because, you know, if Arabia is such a backwater, how does it have the political autonomy to actively resist mortuary practices from these sort of major ideologically dominant trading partners? And so applying isotope studies to these kinds of commingled collections has, I think, really changed the way we think about this region's role in interregional economic networks.
A quick follow-up on that. So this is kind of, the history of anthropology is rich sometimes with these types of themes. So if we go back to Malinowski and the Trobriand Islands, he essentially argued, this is a very complex economic exchange that is maybe underappreciated or under-respected in other parts of the world. So I'm curious, did you go into this research with ideas like this on the forefront, or was this were these types of analyses something that emerged as you looked at the basic science?
They certainly emerged as I was looking at the basic science. I was interested more in local mobility and whether we could see people, for example, moving between the coast and the mountains in some kind of seasonal way, which we thought was happening in this earlier period in the Neolithic. I was curious about similar questions in the Bronze Age as people were beginning to settle down, and we see the appearance of these sort of monumental structures occurring in these settlements for the first time. But as I began reading more about kind of theory and these economic models in this and other regions, as well as then looking at the isotopic data, these two things sort of came together and became something that I got really interested in pursuing. This idea that these backwaters actually, you know, were pretty autonomous and certainly held their own and had power in their own unique way, you know, despite interacting with these sort of core centers.
I love the diversity of questions and sort of mysteries that you can get into with your work. And I love that Eric is taking us in a really intellectual way. So I'm gonna do the opposite and go all pop on us. In your bio, you are involved in a really compelling project, and I imagine it catches the attention of undergrads and 50-something-year-old people alike. So you also study embodied social identity, and you worked in a post-medieval cemetery where that's known for deviant burials, and you've looked into vampirism in relation to it. So can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was fortunate enough to be invited by a colleague onto this project. So I was sort of a consultant bioarchaeologist coming into this project on a post-medieval cemetery in northwestern Poland at the site of Drawsko. And there is this cemetery sort of in the middle of a farm field, in the middle of nowhere. And most of the burials are totally normal. Individuals, but every once in a while they would come across an individual who would have a sickle placed across their neck, or a sickle placed across their abdomen, or rocks holding their jaws, their mandibles in place. And the idea was sort of based on the literature, on Slavic folklore and tradition, that these individuals were suspected of having the potential to become vampires or revenants or some other kind of creature. And as a result, they needed to use some kind of what we call an apotropaic practice, so a practice meant to prevent evil, to stop these individuals from becoming this revenant. And so to do that, they would place, for example, an iron sickle across the neck. And the idea here was that if this individual did become a vampire and attempted to rise from their grave, their head would be removed by the sharp blade of the sickle, and they would be unable to attack the living.
That is just, that's really fascinating. How did they find you and say, hey, Dr. Gregorica, we got this. This is right down your alley.
Yeah, it's a good question, because they had been doing this work, you know, long before I had come along and had made these sort of vampiric discoveries. They brought me in because of my expertise in biogeochemistry. And so what I did was to look at the isotopes in their teeth to see whether these individuals were local to the area or non-local. And we have literature that talks about all the different reasons why someone might be more likely to become a vampire. So maybe you were born out of wedlock, maybe you weren't baptized, maybe you were disabled in some way, or there's just sort of this other category, and that includes, you know, people who are different from you. And that could potentially include migrants. And we know during this time, a lot of migrants are coming into Poland, particularly because of its political and religious freedoms during this time. And so I looked at the isotopes from a number of individuals in the cemetery, not only the normal burials, but the deviant burials as well. And what we found were a variety of non-local individuals in the cemetery, but all of them were buried in a normal way. For the deviant burials, all of them were local. And I found that to be really fascinating because, you know, they had done studies before I arrived trying to figure out what made these individuals different. And in terms of health and disease, there was no differences between kind of the normal and the deviant burials. So the isotopes showed the same thing. They were just local people, just like us. And so obviously, there is some other social stigma that is marking them, you know, in that way. There's a reason they were targeted, but it wasn't because of being non-local.
That's really neat. So it connects your interest in mobility and your ability to look at those patterns to just an utterly fascinating question. People, this is why, I don't know about you, Leslie, this is why I got into anthropology, because I could be called on to, like, look into completely interesting, fascinating, bizarre questions that I never, ever, ever thought to ask. And on the other side of things, you're laying the groundwork for the ethical practice. And you mentioned one of the issues in the field is, are we producing too many bioarchaeologists, right? And I guess that what that would mean to is it leads to us fetishizing collections and having these collections around so that we can train students. And you sent us An article that came out in Levant last year called The Ethics of Excavating, Bioarchaeology, and the Case for Rehabilitating Legacy Human Skeletal Collections in the Near East. I wonder if you could just start with a sort of broad, like, what was the inspiration for writing this piece?
Yeah, in terms of inspiration, I think it was just, you know, walking into these storerooms, which I think most archaeologists and bioarchaeologists have this experience, whether you're here in the US or abroad, and being overwhelmed by the amount of material that has been excavated by other people for decades or even for centuries in the case of working in the Middle East. And it's like Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? Where the Ark of the Covenant is hidden away in this huge warehouse full of nondescript crates. And you wonder, you know, where is all this material coming from? But also, is anybody even studying this anymore? Why do we hold on to these things and become sort of hoarders and owners of the past where these things are excavated? Maybe there's a preliminary report, maybe there's not. And then they're just sort of pushed to the side and we continue to excavate looking for more and more things. And so these sorts of legacy collections where, and I should step back and maybe define what I mean by these. Legacy collections are where we have collections that were excavated in the past, where we have a little bit of contextual information from the archaeological record, but the collection does not really meet the curation standards of today. They need someone to come in and work on it to make sure that it's properly curated and documented before it can be studied. We also have what are called orphaned collections, and these are similar to legacy collections, but they're usually in much poorer condition, and they may not have as much contextual information that is directly associated with the bones. So I think a lot of bioarchaeologists, sort of as you were saying before with the vampires, they enter this discipline because they're excited about research and these discoveries that they want to make that come with it. And, you know, I feel that way too. But at the same time, I think we need to be more reflexive about why we excavate in the first place and ask ourselves if our research goals can actually be accomplished without disturbing even more human burials. And this is where these legacy collections come in. It's not an easy choice to make to tackle a legacy collection. It requires that we substitute excavation for what we call rehabilitation. And I think for a lot of bioarchaeologists, there's this loss of identity if we're not excavating. But I would argue that rehabilitation is equally, if not more important. You know, it means committing serious time to combing through the field notes of other people, to reattach context to these bodies, and to work to properly curate these collections. But if these kinds of collections can help us to answer similar research questions that we can do by excavating, and of course that we have consent to study them, that's obviously important, we have to seriously consider this as a more ethical option. And so I would argue it's our ethical responsibility to do this. Again, why would do we keep these collections around in the first place if we are not going to study them, if we're just leaving them to sort of atrophy on the shelves? And I do want to make clear that I am not trying to advocate for a moratorium on excavation. I still think it is super important for us to do this as bioarchaeologists. But I think it's also time for us to recognize that we need to take responsibility for our predecessors who accumulated these collections in the first place. And we need to normalize working with these kinds of collections instead of constantly generating these new individuals for study.
I wonder, I really like the, you know, the phrase of rehabilitating these collections, but I wonder what's the, in your opinion, what's the ethical procedure when maybe the notes or have been lost or are not sufficient to add, you know, to add proper context to the remains of an individual or even the remains of an entire collection?
Absolutely. You know, if that context isn't there and it sort of forces us to consider, can we really even study this and can it contribute to a broader knowledge base about the past? At that time, that's when we need to consider repatriation and reburial, because why hold on to something that isn't going to allow us to, you know, gain that sort of information? So repatriation and reburial, that isn't just something we do if we don't have consent. It's also something we need to consider instead of just holding these people. I mean, these are once living people. And I think that's kind of easily forgotten when they're just bones sitting on a shelf. But we need to think a little bit more deeply about the ramifications of what we do and the collections that are in our care that we are stewards of.
This issue, I mean, it's been brewing for a long time, and you could speak to this certainly better than either Eric or I. We're not bioarchaeologists. I had the inauspicious responsibility of filling in as an advisor for a couple of bioarch students during the COVID pivot when, you know, so I that's when I became super aware and started seeing a lot of people change how they conduct their research. So I'm just curious for you, not since COVID, but just like, what's the arc been in your career? This seems like a recent turn, but maybe I'm myopic. How has this affected your career and how you've worked over the course of it?
I think initially, at least, the work that I did followed this trajectory. And this is because the advisors that I had were already working with these kinds of collections. And so it just was a natural path for me to do the same thing and to work along with them. And so, for example, even in my undergraduate work, I was working with commingled collections that had previously been excavated by somebody else. What I found is that I was working with individuals that most other bioarchaeologists were actively avoiding. You know, these are bodies, I mentioned the commingling, which just means the bones are all mixed up. We don't have these discrete individual burials. They're also fragmentary. Some of them have been cremated. And so you do lose that context of having these discrete individual burials that enables you to ask more complex kinds of questions. You know, at the same time, I've always felt kind of strongly that ignoring these kinds of collections is just not an option, because we can't make the excuse that they're sort of quote unquote too difficult to study, because in doing so, we would be ignoring a huge part of the past, especially in the Middle East, where commingled and these kinds of interments are so common in prehistory. And so we just end up further marginalizing these groups by not studying them. You know, your point is sort of interesting about what happened in your own department. And I think more broadly with COVID as well, when people weren't able to go into the field, they began thinking about different kinds of ways that they could approach legacy collections, or, you know, beginning to digitize certain collections and approaching research from that perspective. And that, I think, sort of shifted the way that the field began thinking about things as well. But certainly that discussion, along with discussions of consent, of repatriation and reburial, all of that was sort of crashing together around the same time over the past decade.
One thing I'm curious about is the how journals are handling this. So it seems that some journals are starting to require proof that researchers have consent from the dissent communities. So I'm wondering how journals are enforcing that.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see academic journals adopting more stringent regulations for ethical review. It's certainly a good thing. Our flagship journal, the American Journal of Biological Anthropology, is a really great example of this. They're asking authors to provide details surrounding the ethics in the final text of the manuscript, and also as a separate form that has to be submitted with the manuscript. And I don't know if either of you have looked over this form, but it's no joke. They require a lot of detailed information surrounding ethics and consent. But the question is a good one, because, you know, where do we go beyond that? Is there a way to even enforce this beyond these statements? You know, is there any kind of investigation after you make an ethics statement to confirm details or, you know, numbers that are associated with permits? I don't know if there are any easy answers to this, but I do think it means that we're on the right track as a field. And it gets back to a point that I talk a little bit about in the article, which is taking accountability, going beyond what is strictly mandated, and holding ourselves accountable in higher ways. And part of that means normalizing this process, not just for ourselves, but for our students, so that by the time we get to the next generation of bioarchaeologists, it is second nature for them to ask these kinds of questions and to obtain consent and to work with rights holders or dissent communities from the very beginning of a project, instead of doing a project and then kind of scrambling and thinking about it only at the end, you know, did they do the right thing? That then brings me to another issue, which is thinking about the end of the project as well. And this is something that these kinds of ethics requirements from journals, unfortunately, don't really address right now. So where will these skeletons be stored after the research is done, after people have left that field season? What conditions are they going to be stored under? And how can we make sure that they continue to be cared for once we leave? So I think we really need a culture shift in the way we think about this sort of before and after of our work. And that means thinking about ways that our funding needs to go toward long-term curation strategies, and not, when we're putting together our budget, just thinking about things like buying plane tickets for our team or paying for food while we're in the field. We really have to think long-term, and that also means that granting agencies need to buy into this as well and be ready to provide funds for either continued curation after we're done or for repatriation and reburial. So when we talk about this ethics of excavating, this is not about whether we should excavate or not. It's about whether we're prepared to care for these individuals, essentially in perpetuity after an excavation has taken place.
This is all fascinating, and it sounds huge. I mean, it sounds like a major effort or endeavor to garner funding to protect this stuff in perpetuity. And you're absolutely right. It is the right thing to do. And the impulse of a lot of folks who are trying to establish their careers will be to take shortcuts, because that's how you get LPU. So I'm curious, I know you have an REU, how you train people to get into this field ethically from the beginning so that they don't walk into it feeling this overwhelming responsibility to do it all themselves.
Yeah, so we had a pretty extensive and well-established ethics component to our REU. And I mentioned that REU that I was actually a part of as an undergraduate in the very beginning. So this is a different REU that we run now, or actually we just ended the REU. So it's 2024
oh,
was
oh, well.
Our last year. Yeah. But we tried to approach it from a variety of angles, making sure that students had a good foundational understanding of ethics sort of generally in the field and the conversations that were happening. We would bring in ethics speakers to talk to the students about projects, including excavation projects, and what was happening with those. And we even had an established ethics advisor, Dr. Molly Zuckerman, who would come in and talk specifically about sort of where are we going in the field of bioarchaeology and what are the steps that we actually need to take to make sure that we are acting ethically today in the 21st century, and how that obviously differed pretty significantly from what was done in the past. And students want to learn this stuff. They were on top of these kinds of debates and questions. And this was probably where we saw the most passion from students coming from, was wanting to make sure that they not only had an understanding, but that things that were being done bioarchaeologically were, you know, being conducted in an ethical way. So I'm really excited to see this next generation, I think, move forward with a lot of these concepts and ideas and take them probably even further than what we're conceptualizing right now.
How about what's up next for you?
So I am going to be continuing my work on legacy collections in the UAE. And I talked about this a little bit, looking at these early Bronze Age commingled tombs, which I've been conducting research on for over a decade. But I'm pretty excited to begin investigating tombs from the following period, which are really different, but at the same time, were clearly built by the same people. And so I'm interested in asking questions about what is causing these sorts of changes for a tomb to have 500 individuals in it and to look a certain way. And then all of a sudden, within a few hundred years, we see something that looks very, very different. Why did that happen? And what can these changes from a funerary perspective actually tell us about changes within the living community and their social structure? So, yeah, that's what I'll be working on next.
Our last question for you is, let's say you're going to be joining us at the HBA, next week. We have a hypothetical talent show that we put on. And if we do see you there next week, and you've had a few in you and you volunteer for the talent show, what will you be entertaining us with?
Oh, this is a good question. So I don't really know if this is a talent, but you know, I'm a transplant to the Gulf Coast, and I have learned to really love Mardi Gras. And I don't know if you know this, Chris, but you've lived in Alabama for a while now. Mobile is actually the birthplace of Mardi Gras. And Mobilians really like to rub this fact in the face of New Orleans. And we, like them, have all sorts of big parades and balls and parties here prior to Mardi Gras, which is great. But along with all of that, there are foods that can only be eaten during this very specific period of time. And no food is more important than king cake.
Hell
And
yes.
and people who know me, they know that I have a pretty big sweet tooth. So it maybe isn't that surprising that I gravitated toward this particular tradition. But a few years ago during COVID, I began documenting my king cake tasting adventures online. So every Mardi Gras season, I travel to different bakeries all around the Gulf Coast. I write up these ridiculously detailed kind of flowery reviews based on the quality of the cake and the taste, that kind of thing. And I rank all the cakes I try at the very end of Mardi Gras. And I actually went back this year and counted how many cakes I've tried since all of this started. And I'm very proud to say that I have eaten close to 50 different king cakes from 50 different bakeries.
Awesome.
So this is all a really long way of saying that my talent would be that I consider myself to be a bit of a king cake expert. And so at the HBAs, I would be able to select the best king cake for everyone to eat. But I don't really know if it's cheating to say that my talent is eating, but there you go.
Hell no, that's my favorite talent that I've heard so far. And I'm trying to remember the name of there's a podcast that I listen to, Beyond Bourbon Street,
Oh, I'll have to check it out.
with a great episode on king cake. How can people find out more about you and your work? Are you on the socials? Do you have a website? What do you want to advertise?
I'm on the socials. I have a website, and my name is pretty unique. So just by Googling my name, you will immediately find all of those things.
That's a true fact, actually. If you spell it correctly,
You spell it
if you
correctly.
spell it correctly. Eric, what about you?
Email's best, eric.griffith@duke.edu. And what about you, Chris?
You can find me on all kinds of socials. I've got websites, I've got emails. But on Twitter, I'm at Chris underscore LY. The Human Biology Association also has a site, humbio.org. And our Twitter is humbioassoc. And I know it's not called that anymore. And we have Instagram and all the rest too, which you can find out about by your trusty overlord, Google. Thank you all. And, you're over spring break. I'm on spring break. I'm gonna go enjoy the rest of my spring break. Peace out, everybody.
Enjoy.
Yes, have
Bye-bye.
fun.
Bye.